Innovations. It's co-hosted by Lenaya Quinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, and Laura Sumner Kuhn, a former journalist at the Racine Journal-Times, who currently serves as an adjunct instructor at UW Parkside. Community Matter shares its time slot with the WGTD Radio Theater. And now, here's today's program. This program originally aired November 16th.
Good morning, and welcome to Community Matters. I'm Laura Sumner Kuhn, your host this morning, and I'm so excited to have our guests for a very timely discussion. This show is coming to you, listeners, just as we've broken a number of records. We've had probably the snowiest fall we have ever had. We've broken temperatures for cold. Here in mid-November, we've already had to postpone trick-or-treating on Halloween due to an unusual snow. Temperatures have dipped below zero already with the wind chill factor. And there was a new study that was just released, I heard about earlier this week, saying that in the southern half of the United States, they're projecting that by mid-century, there'll be more 100-degree days and things that we should be paying attention to. And lucky for us, those of us who might just know enough to say, gee, this is unusual, today we have experts who could really tell us more. And they're here today because this Sunday, November 17th, they will be speaking at the Climate Crisis Science Consequences and Solutions Conference at Case High School Auditorium at 1:30. And they will be bringing more information to the public. It's a free conference for information that's sponsored by Greening Greater Racine. So I'd like to introduce our guest today, who I'm delighted have taken the time to be with us. Joining us by telephone is Bob Lindmeyer. He's a longtime meteorologist, the chief meteorologist at WKOW-TV in Madison. He's a member of the American Meteorological Society, and he's on a committee of station scientists, a group that promotes the effort to recognize television station meteorologists as scientists. He's also a member of the Citizens Climate Lobby, and he lives in Oregon, Wisconsin, with his family. Hi, Bob. Thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure to be here.
Great. We also have in studio with us Kara Pratt. Kara is the very first Sustainability and Conservation Coordinator for the City of Racine, and she was appointed by Mayor Corey Mason to the Water Utility and the Mayor's Office. She's tasked with developing a water conservation program and working with community groups such as Greening Greater Racine to develop Racine's first equitable climate action plan. She has an interesting history. She has worked with the World Wildlife Fund, the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, and the Coalition for Private Investment and Conservation, where she was helping to promote the importance of investing in forest conservation. So welcome, Kara. I'm glad you're here today.
Thank you for having me.
And we have Tom Rakowski. Tom is a Racinian, and he's chair of the Southeast Gateway Group of the Sierra Club, which includes Kenosha, Racine, and Walworth counties. And he is a founding member of the Clean Power Coalition of Southeastern Wisconsin, a group of 25 environmental, religious, and social justice groups that work together to pressure We Energies to retire its coal plants and adopt renewable energy. Tom has worked with the Citizens Climate Lobby, and he has organized the Southeast Wisconsin Solar Group for its first 3 years. So welcome, Tom. Hi. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So we have three wonderful people who have much more knowledge than I do about climate. I know enough to say, holy cow, it is really cold, and I better warm up the car and put on my mittens. But why don't you, Bob, tell us, if you could, what you're seeing happening now as concerning climate in our area, in our state, in our country, in our world, and what the projections look like.
Yes, the climate is warming, and there's absolutely no doubt about that. in the scientific world that I reside in. I am a television meteorologist, but I am a meteorologist, so I'm a scientist in my training. So I've been able to look at what climate scientists are saying and then bring that to the public. So a lot of my work involves climate change education and dispelling a lot of the misinformation that's out there, and give people really the facts when it comes to climate change. Our climate is warming overall across the world. It's in the average atmospheric temperature has increased 1 degree Celsius, which is about 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit, since the start of the Industrial Revolution. And that's not a coincidence. The reason that our atmosphere is warm starting then is because the Industrial Revolution is when we started burning fossil fuels and oil and coal and natural gas to a certain extent. And what the burning of those fossil fuels has done is put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And the atmosphere's responded to that. And as a consequence, it has warmed. It has warmed 1 degree Celsius. And what that's done has essentially supercharged our atmosphere. And we're seeing extreme events become more extreme. And it might be counterintuitive, but this extremely cold weather that we've been experiencing over the last couple of weeks, we're actually pretty much going into our third consecutive week now of below average temperatures, and much of those below average temperatures have been way below average. And as you mentioned, we've had snow, or we've had a record-setting amount of snow this fall. Now, it might be counterintuitive. You say, well, it's really cold. Where's climate change? But extreme events include cold snaps. So climate change more than likely has its fingerprints on this very cold weather that we're experiencing. But I might say that this is weather that we're experiencing right now, the last 3 weeks. This is not climate. Weather is measured in days and weeks. Climate is measured in years, decades, and centuries. So don't put a overemphasis on our cold weather and say, well, where's all that warm air? Because if you look at the global perspective, what you're going to find is, yes, we're cold. But overall, the entire world is still well above average. And this month, like every month this year and for many years, is going to be one of the warmest ever when you look at it from a worldwide perspective. So our atmosphere is warming. It's warmed in Wisconsin. It's warmed in Racine. When I talk on Sunday, I'm going to have some very specific numbers for Racine. In terms of how much it's warmed and the impacts that Racine are experiencing from our changing climate. But I can say that it's warm more than the worldwide average because we're closer to the North Pole, which is warming faster than any part of the world. So we're feeling that. And that warming is having local effects in our changing climate. We've had, as you know, extreme rainfall events over the last couple of years occur, and this is what a climate scientist expect to happen, because every 1 degree centigrade or Celsius increase in the worldwide atmospheric temperature brings 4% more water vapor into our atmosphere, because the oceans are warming and evaporating more. So that 4% increase in water vapor is manifesting itself as more extreme rainfall events. We're seeing it with hurricanes down along the coast. They're producing more rainfall. And here in the upper Midwest, storm systems that come through have more moisture to tap into. So these extreme events, these heavy rainfall events, are more heavy. So climate change is not causing extreme events per se, but it's making those events, when they happen, worse.
It would be interesting.
That's kind of it in a nutshell.
Right. And as people who live along Lake Michigan, one of the largest bodies of water around, what effect does it have from Lake Michigan as we have rising climate and water evaporation from the lake?
Yeah, it's having an effect. It's not as an obvious effect as some of the other things, like our warmer than normal temperatures, our winters, which are much warmer than normal. But the lakes are feeling the effects of climate change as well. And it's showing itself at times as record high lake levels that have occurred from time to time over the last few years. So there is an effect from the Great Lakes. It's something I'll delve into a little bit more tomorrow, but that factor is there.
Hmm. Kara, you are charged with a lot in keeping tabs on water quality here in Racine and just the effect of our carbon footprint in our local area. Can you tell us a little bit about how what Bob has laid out for us intersects with what you're doing for the city of Racine?
Sure. So in the wake of climate change, you notice that the issue has become quite politicized. And so there's different levels at which entities can take action. And so we have a federal body that decides to pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement, where that causes a lot of devastation to people like me who are professionals in the field. However, you notice that municipalities, cities across the world, and businesses have really stepped up and said, we're still in. We are still interested in tackling this wicked problem that's the biggest problem our generation will face. And so what the city has done and what Mayor Corey Mason has committed to is reaffirming our commitment to the Paris Climate Accord. So Racine's City Council in 2018, thanks to wide community support, recommitted to the Paris Climate Accord, which means that we're now measuring the city's carbon footprint for the first time. And in order to make data-based decisions, we need to first have the data. So we are right now conducting an energy audit on our fleet and facilities in order to understand our city's carbon footprint. And I have some numbers here.
Great.
So our water utility and wastewater utility are responsible for more than half of the city operations carbon footprints. So you can see that providing clean water to Racine residents and also handling sewage is more than 50% of our carbon footprint due to the energy costs associated with those processes.
So maybe we should step back a little bit and any of you can jump in. And, you know, we hear that term carbon footprint a lot. What is exactly encompassed in that? What are we looking at in ways of our effect on the world?
I think we're looking at the overall output of carbon into the atmosphere. I thank Bob for speaking out. I think, you know, having meteorologists is really a credible source of information. And I wish that we lived in a world where the science was accepted, because that science has been very accurate for the last 30 years. And there's an interesting article in the New York Times just last Sunday called How Science Got It So Wrong. And they're not disputing any of the predictions about science. The thing is, the one thing they got wrong, probably the most serious thing, is that they weren't aggressive enough in predicting. Things are happening much faster than they thought they would. And, you know, it explains there was a perceived need for consensus among scientists and so on. So there's many reasons. But I would like to say that right now, you know, it would be great if facts and persuasion and passion all had a say. But there's also an economic picture. So a little over a year ago, there was a study by a financial firm named Lazard that said that it would be cheaper to build new renewables, wind and solar, than to run existing coal plants. Sierra Club recently entered testimony in We Energy's rate case, and our economists testified that the South Oak Creek plant, the older of the two that's been operating since 50s and 60s, is costing an additional $73 million above and beyond the cost of available renewables from the Midwestern grid. So the cost of solar and wind has gone down dramatically, so there's also an economic argument. And I'd like to say that renewables are also widely popular on both sides of that political divide. And so we need a group, and that's what the Clean Power Coalition does. We need a group to pressure We Energies. We need to make this transition sooner than later. the chief executive of WEC Energy Group, said that, you know, he reassured shareholders that they're going to be burning coal till 2050. That's not reassuring to the rest of us, particularly the ones who are paying attention to the science.
So during this time that we're trying to understand what a carbon footprint is and how we have gotten to this point in kind of propelling climate change, we have compacted our reaction time. And so getting back, Kara, to you, what data have you discovered so far? As you were saying that the water and wastewater treatment plant for the city generates the most carbon, I guess it would be. And why is that? When we think about water and wastewater treatment, I don't necessarily think of it as being such a consumer of energy. Can you explain what happens in the utility that makes that fact so?
So these are tremendously energy-intensive processes to treat our water and wastewater. And obviously, we need to have these systems functioning 24/7 every day of the year. And so this is why you start to see high costs associated with this process. And this is absolutely a public need. So I don't mention this because I think it's a tremendous opportunity to reduce the carbon for these specific plants, but I think it is important for people to know that there is a cost associated with these services. We turn on a tap, and there's energy behind that as well. It's not just water. And something that's even more illustrative is 22% of the city operational carbon footprint is for fuel, only fuel. That's for our fleet vehicles and for our bus systems. And that is a tremendous opportunity because there's so much technology these days. We can move towards electric vehicles, and especially the matching of electric vehicles powered with alternative energy is something that can completely change our city's carbon footprint and also has secondary effects of improving our air quality. Southeastern Wisconsin has some of the poorest air quality in the United States, and that's something that we can change. There's actions that we can take to pressure our utilities to think about alternative energy in a different way.
What kind of technology exists to replace the running of the utility plants? Is there technology that has been developed that could take on the running of a wastewater treatment plant or a water treatment plant?
So our wastewater treatment plant in Racine already runs 60% of its electricity based off of methane gas that's captured from the process of treating wastewater. And so this is not traditionally considered an alternative energy. This is something that the city has done for years and years, and many wastewater treatment plants do this. So it's not only the most innovative and forward-thinking technology that we're talking about. It's some things that are tried and trusted that we're aware of. And then the other opportunities, of course, are rooftop solar and ground mount solar. There are the roof space in the city of Racine is a tremendous asset, and we're, despite what some people might think, a very sunny part of the world. Solar has tremendous opportunity in southeastern Wisconsin.
So maybe you can describe the difference, either one, anybody on the panel can describe maybe the difference between rooftop and what was the other option,
ground mount solar,
or just panels that are mounted in the ground, is that it? Okay. And does anybody have a clue about how much of southeastern Wisconsin's or Racine's energy is provided by alternative sources as opposed to traditional carbon burning sources?
So I have an idea of how many residences and businesses in Racine have solar, and it's a very small amount. And I have solar at my house. I charge my electric car. If we went at the pace of, you know, that many individuals per year, we would be doing this for 100 years. We need to ramp up this, and that's why having our utility switch to renewables, to aggressively pursue renewables, that's an option where, you know, 50% of the energy Racine uses could be renewables if that energy that comes from We Energies was from renewables.
So,
I could just add on that a little bit.
Could you, Bob?
Mm-hmm. Is that just from a statewide perspective, only 10% of electricity produced in Wisconsin is from renewable energy. 90% is still primarily from coal. So we're lagging behind our neighboring states in this regard. We have a long ways to go. We are seeing an increasing number of solar farms coming online. Wind farms have been lagging, but it sounds like those are going to start to increase in numbers as well. It's not been a good situation for Wisconsin. A lot of that is, I think, driven by our state legislature. They have to be more supportive of this transition over to renewables. They're kind of holding. They've in the past holding back the state in doing this transition in a faster manner.
What kind of a turnaround do we need in order to see some kind of effect on the overall impeding of climate warming? Is there enough that we can do fast enough to actually, stop this trend, or our hope would be reverse it eventually? But what's realistic for us to think about in terms of time and need?
Yeah, I can say that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, put out a report earlier this year that states that we have 12 years to cut global emissions in half to meet a 1.5 degree C overall increase in global temperatures. So another half degree centigrade increase in global temperatures will require a 50% cut in global emissions when it comes to what we're putting in the atmosphere from fossil fuels. And that's a big task, but that's what we have to try to strive for, because at 1.5 degrees C, we're still going to experience extreme events that are worse than they were 50 years ago. However, if we go to 2 degrees Celsius, it's going to be an order of magnitude even more worse. And if you go above 2 degrees C, then you're talking a catastrophic climate change. So the objective for the world is, and this is what the Paris Accord stated as a goal, was to keep the overall atmospheric temperature from climbing only one half of a degree more. However, as I just said, we only have 12 years to cut global emissions in half to reach that goal, which is going to be a tough goal to reach.
Well, you have to get agreement from everyone around the world, right? And does anybody on the panel understand or know or have a good grasp on how much of emissions the United States is responsible for? Do we output more greenhouse gases than any other country? Where do we fit kind of in that scope?
So I believe that China is probably the largest emitter, and India also. And people will have the argument, well, until China and India cleans up. But historically, the U.S. has been the most significant contributor to global warming, climate change.
Yeah, those three countries are by far the leaders, so to speak, in terms of producing greenhouse gas emissions.
And there's an important distinction to make, and that's that emissions should be measured per capita. And if you're comparing the United States to China and India, our human population in the United States is significantly lower. So the responsibility of the United States is tremendous in this field. We have such a responsibility to change and lead in this space, and we haven't been.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine then coalitions that you're all somewhat involved in and partnering with other either municipal or state organizations is so important in driving this point home. What kind of collaborative efforts are we making here in Wisconsin and in Racine? Anybody who could, and Kenosha, if anybody could kind of speak to that from your end of things, that would be wonderful.
Well, it's
go ahead.
Well, it's heartening to see that Governor Evers just established a climate task force for the state. So that's a big step, and that's action we haven't seen for quite a while. Go ahead, Bob.
I was just going to mention that, you know, in terms of solutions where we have to go from here, it's the bottom line is I've been giving this talk for the last 4 or 5 years. I've given it over 60 times. When I first gave it, I would end with reducing your footprint, all right? But I was realizing that people were saying to me, Bob, there's got to be more to get ourselves out of this mess. And when I did research on this, now this is getting away from my expertise, but it became very clear to me that putting a price on carbon was essential for us to be able to drive this change from burning fossil fuels to renewable energy, for it to happen fast enough to be able to reach this goal of cutting global emissions in half by 12 years. Without a price on carbon, it's just not going to happen, because we've had for years what economists call a market failure. And that's because the costs of climate change are not factored into the price of fossil fuels, coal and oil. And so when it's for our economy, what we pay for the fossil fuels is not truly representative of their cost. And until we change that and get the true cost of fossil fuels corrected for climate change damage, then we're just not going to get there. But there are ways, and there's legislation that's in place in the House of Representatives that can address that and really can make a big difference in cutting our emissions.
Let me understand this a little bit better. So in other words, as is with most things, unfortunately, there has to be some kind of economic incentive or economic penalty in order to encourage such vast change. Is that pretty much what you're summing up? Either we need to look at tagging on some kind of surcharge to processes that use fossil fuels, or adding great incentive for a switch to renewable energy sources in order for this to happen in a more timely fashion that our Earth depends upon. Is that what I hear you saying?
Essentially, yes. Carbon pricing has been something that's been enacted around the world for many years, including the United States, in California, along the West Coast, and also in the Northeast United States. There's carbon pricing that has been enacted. Some of it's in the form of cap and trade. Others, for other parts of the world, it's a carbon tax. Now, for many parts of the world, though, they've been struggling with carbon pricing and a carbon tax, because specifically it is a tax. What I envision, what I support, is a carbon fee and dividend. And the fundamental difference is that the fees that are collected from the energy companies, then there's a price per ton of CO2 that will be calculated, and what they're going to have to pay for the coal and oil that they produce. But those fees are returned directly to us as citizens, instead of having to go to the government and let them dole out these billions of dollars that would be collected. And by having us as citizens receive that fee as a dividend, means that we can mitigate our energy costs, because energy costs will be going up substantially as carbon pricing is enacted. But by us having this dividend in our pockets, and it's all just driven by household size, we can it can help us deal with this transition as it happens. And I think it's going to be a critical part of what we do in terms of getting ourselves out of this mess that we're in.
I'm curious about how that actually works. I'm trying to wrap my mind around this, as some of our listeners may, since this is not my area of study. What is to prevent the utility companies just to continually go back to their citizen utility boards and ask for increasing rates because they are the cost of providing that energy source is going up, and because then they have to pay this tax or dividend back to users. I don't know. I'm not seeing exactly how that translates into moving us to change. If it's money coming back into my own pocket, you have to trust that there will be a substantial number of citizens who will be interested enough and savvy enough to know to use that money to invest in some alternative source. And changing individual habit is a real challenge. We've learned, as we've tried to push people to recycle, right? And how long have we been doing that? And adopt other kinds of day-to-day living habits that help protect our Earth. So obviously there is no one strategy that is going to work alone. But if is anybody using that kind of dividend anywhere that you could explain a little bit more, illustrate a little bit better to us how that might work?
Yeah, I'll be getting into more details about this in the talk. I have a number of slides that illustrate. It's kind of hard, I think, verbally to talk about. It's a fairly complicated subject. However, the fundamental idea of carbon pricing is, again, to make sure that the cost of fossil fuels reflects their damage to the environment. And so the cost of the fossil fuels are going to be so much higher. And so the renewable energy sources are going to be that much more attractive economically. Right now, solar and wind are cheaper than coal. However, when you put carbon pricing, it'll be even more of a differential. So this is going to drive our economy. Just the economy, as it naturally will work, is going to want to go to the most economical way to produce energy. It's going to accelerate the decommissioning of coal plants. It's going to even get us away from natural gas, which is not a good alternative. The wind and solar will become so much more attractive and will lead to this massive investment in these alternative energies. And so that gives us our goal of transitioning over to renewables at this pace that it needs to be at to reach the IPCC goal. Okay. So, but there's going to be a cost involved, obviously. Our cost of energy is going to increase substantially. But by having this dividend, by having the dividend from the power from the power companies come directly to us, that just mitigates the cost.
Okay. I would imagine, now, too, and at a corporate level, that makes a whole difference to businesses who are operating and could see potentially substantial savings by making the switch. We'll have to depend on their leadership somewhat to help get us to that point where we can actually see some benefit from their change of mindset.
I think it's important here also to mention the social cost of carbon. This is a concept that we talk about in economics, that there's externalities that our economy doesn't account for currently. And these are things like high asthma rates around coal plants and the public health effects of climate change. I was fortunate to be in a room with many other peers in my position across the United States. So there were representatives from Miami and from California who were flying to Detroit to talk about climate change, and they were coming from areas where there's profound flooding in Miami, and there's profound, the forest fires in parts of California today have such a tremendous public health cost and also an economic cost. All signs point to action on climate change. It doesn't make sense not to make these changes anymore.
Just to tag on to that, 114,000 lives are lost each year just due to air pollution. And by drastically cutting these emissions, it's projected that 295,000 lives can be saved through 2030 because of better air quality by enacting this carbon pricing and dramatically reducing the emissions from coal-fired plants. So that I think, you know, even taking the economics aside, just that savings in lives would make it justifiable.
Mm-hmm. Tom, you were going to jump in here?
Yeah, I'd like to say that it's difficult to get a perspective on this, but I think this transition is happening much more rapidly in other parts of the world and other parts of the country than here, and that's largely due to policies that we've had. And I just wanted to say that in Alliant Energy in Madison just announced last week that they're going to install 1 gigawatt of solar. That's a project that will multiply the amount of solar in the state of Wisconsin 10 times. Recently, Invergy announced plans to build a large 300-megawatt plant, solar plant in Paris Township, which will include the state's first battery storage. So much of the argument against renewables is variable when the sun doesn't shine. Well, the battery technology is also taking off. Cost of batteries is rapidly decreasing. And so that makes it possible to kind of smooth out the differences. And the joke is that somebody goes to a climate conference and raises his hand and said, well, what if climate change is a hoax and we build a better world for nothing? And the point is that, you know, we will benefit from cleaner air, cleaner water, and we have every reason, including the economic reason, to rapidly proceed with this transition.
So maybe in the final minutes that we have for our discussion today, we can talk a little bit about the average person, because as we've mentioned, this is an incredibly large problem, and it requires a lot of collaboration across countries' boundaries as well as our own backyards. What can the average person do to be able to reduce their carbon footprint and play a role in this change?
So I mentioned that. Go ahead, Bob.
I was just going to say that the points I would make is, number one, try if at all possible to make this conference tomorrow. I think that your listeners will learn a lot. And from what you learn from this conference, have discussions with your friends and family, because climate change is kind of the elephant in the room. It's not discussed that much, but we have to bring it to the forefront of our minds. So by just talking with your friends and family, you can have a significant impact on them to have them think more about it. And then finally, it comes down to politicians, making sure that when we go to the vote polling booths, that we're voting for candidates, whether it's at the city level, state, federal level, that they are cognizant of climate change and are prepared to do what it takes to make the proper changes. And lastly, you can influence your legislators by emailing them, by calling them, letting them know that you're concerned about this. Because one thing I've learned through my efforts in Citizens Climate Lobby, which is laser focused on this carbon fiend dividend solution, is that they do keep track of what their constituents are saying when it comes to any subject. But if you email and call them, you can help influence them going into the future.
I'd also like people to ask some questions. Why is the U.S. the only country in the world that's withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accord? Why is the U.S. the one country where your political orientation pretty much determines your view on climate change? I think everyone else accepts it as a problem of physics and chemistry, and yet here it's this polarized issue, right? We could have acted, and there was a time when politicians on both sides agreed that we needed to act. And yet we kind of squander that opportunity.
Right. Kara, what do you think as somebody who's charged with developing a plan for Racine, Racinians and area neighbors in Kenosha and Walworth counties could also do to change their carbon footprint and help their municipalities reach a goal of playing essential roles in this change?
So in Racine, we're having conversations about both climate change and equity. So it's important to understand the historical inequity in planning and development of cities, in understanding where people live, where low-income people live, and the type of housing that they're usually living in. And so sometimes when we think of solar panels specifically, it's associated with people who have the money to afford such a change. But we are trying to have a conversation about how folks who don't have the resources for something like alternative energy right now can look into efficiency in their homes and also have the secondary public health benefits associated with that. So something like improved insulation and more energy efficient appliances, that reduces your energy bill, that reduces your monthly cost of energy, and also reduces your carbon footprint. So those are the conversations that we're having in order to address the historical inequity within planning in Racine.
Well, that's something that I hadn't thought of. Is there a movement for a place where people could stop to find out more information or get assistance in finding out more information about where more energy efficiencies could be made in the place that they live? Can they do that through the connecting with you at the city or environmental health department at the city? Is there an outlet for that now?
Yes, there's an outlet in the city. There's also a comprehensive loan program for energy efficiency upgrades. And so please approach us at City Hall and also focus on energy. This is something you could search on Google and provides such an array of different opportunities for conducting efficiency upgrades that will save you money and reduce your carbon footprint.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the loan program? So would the city's loan program allow a homeowner to get assistance in installing solar panels?
Yes.
Can you describe a little bit? Do you know a little bit more about that, where you can describe what a typical person would do in order to look at that? Maybe some average cost, Tom, you might have some idea of this. But, you know, if you look at the typical size of a single-family home in Racine, how much would it cost to invest in solar power? And then what resources there are in the city to help pay for that?
Sure. I mentioned earlier that, you know, incentives matter. Germany increased the tariffs, the buyback for renewables, and there was this growth of cooperatives. One thing that other parts of Wisconsin can do that we can't, they have third-party ownership of solar. They have community solar installations where you can purchase a few panels on a nearby school or so on. But at this point, you can get a 30% federal tax credit on solar. So that cuts the payback time by a third. And I can't say exactly how many solar panels you would need, because it depends on how much you use. But when we did the solar group buy, we were talking with people about 8 to 10 year payback period. And remember that, you know, these panels will last for 25, 30 years. So after that first 10 years, you'll have free energy.
Okay. And Kara, any idea of the loan program? Are people taking advantage of that now, or is there capacity to serve many more?
There is certainly capacity to serve more, and we operate on a case-by-case basis. So there's an income adjustment depending on whether these are low-income folks or who's approaching us and talking about a loan. So please come to City Hall, and we're happy to have the conversation.
Great. Well, I so am thankful for the three of you, Bob Lindmeyer, Tom Murkowski, and Kara Pratt, for joining me this morning to talk about this urgent crisis. And for those listeners who wish to find more, please visit Case High School Auditorium tomorrow, Sunday, November 17th, at 1:30 for the conference, Climate Crisis, Science, Consequences, and Solutions. Thank you all for a very interesting and informative morning, and it makes me want to go home and check my house for efficiencies I'm not making. So thank you, and I hope you have a wonderful turnout tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
This program originally aired November 16th. You've been listening to Community Matters. All programs are archived at WGTD.org. Click Shows. This is WGTD HD.